Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Everyone to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again for another fascinating conversation with a fascinating human, an interesting human, I should say, who has a very unique combination that I've never heard of. He is an organic chemist, got his PhD from Princeton, and he's also the former governor of North Carolina, who was elected to two terms. And as we get into the conversation, I will tell you why that is such a unique thing in that state. But I'm here with none other than Dr. and former governor of North Carolina, James G. Martin. How are you doing, sir?
That's pretty scary, Julian. I'm doing fine. And I'm very pleased to meet you and look forward to learning about what you're doing.
Yes, yes. And also he's the author of Revelation Through Science here. So if we're watching on YouTube here, this is the book here. And it is a fascinating book. Oh, he has one too. Yes.
And hundreds.
And, the central thing that we'll get around later in the conversation here is this, if religion and science can coexist. And one of my main things and one of the big messages of the show and just me as a human being is to be able to hold two ideas in one hand and to understand that a lot of things in life is nuance. There's nuances to everything and that you can't hold two ideas in one hand. And a lot of times our viewpoints can sometimes become tribal. So this was a very interesting book that really, I think, addressed that. So I guess the first thing here is I'm a music guy and I was curious, what made you decide on the tuba?
I was big time tuba player with the Charlotte Symphony for about 6 years. When I was in high school, the music director came and you could buy instruments. My dad was a Presbyterian minister, and we figured that we couldn't afford to buy anything. So my choice was whatever you could rent, which was either a drum or a tuba. And I guess my hand-eye coordination wasn't good enough for the drum, so I ended up playing tuba and went from there to playing in college, in the Davidson College Band. And my senior year there, they had a vacancy in the Charlotte Symphony and they needed somebody who could sight read one rehearsal. So I went up, and then when I got back from graduate school, the position was vacant again, so I took it on.
Had a lot of fun. I've always lived vicariously through people who could play instruments. I stuck with sports just because I happen to be good at that. But that's something I still have on my bucket list, is to pick up an instrument, most likely the trumpet or the saxophone. So I have to do one of those things. Do you still go to the symphonies?
Yes, we have. I've been on the board of the Charlotte Symphony, and we have season tickets. Enjoy the performances there.
Yeah, if you're ever in town in Nashville, the Nashville Symphony is also great.
I know it is.
Okay. So it's one of my favorite places in town. Always recommend it. And so I'm curious, a PhD in where did the interest in organic chemistry come from?
Well, you said you were good at athletics. I was pretty good. If they had invented wide receivers back in my day, I might have amounted to something there. I'd play tight end, 165-pound tight end.
Ooh.
What you ask? You ask about organic chemistry. I was a major in chemistry and was fascinated by how you could discover properties and structures of chemicals that you couldn't see with your eyes. And this was back, a long time ago, in the 1950s, late 1950s. And most of what we knew about organic molecular structure was based on wet chemical experiments with reactive reagents. You'd figure out what the structure was you got from a reaction, and on the basis of that, you could work back to figure out what the original structure was. And there's a lot of work done like that. It's fascinating to look at how the structure of DNA was figured out long before the electron microscope was available to show it to you in living color. But that, I was fascinated by that. One of the things that was becoming of more importance in organic in the field at the time that I was in graduate school was the three-dimensional structure. And you look in my book, in the chapter on organic chemistry, it introduces the three-dimensional handedness, the right-handed sugars, the left-handed amino acids that are incorporated into proteins. And it shows you with pictures that look like hands, mirror images, to help you to understand that. The book is written for the educated non-scientists like yourself, who can certainly understand some of it and hopefully enough of it. You don't have to master it. In fact, the book isn't that long. But in what we have, under 400 pages, if you can get to the point where you see that there's something awesome, something miraculous, then I've done my job.
You definitely accomplished that. You definitely accomplished that. I think at times, sometimes we don't really truly just give appreciation for just the wonders of the world and just the DNA and how we're made up and everything. And, just talking about looking at things from a cellular structure all the way to composing this body that we have right now, it's things we kind of take for granted.
Well, let me say that the main purpose of my book is not to tell you what to think. Wouldn't do any good, would it?
Mm-mm. Nope.
You gotta think this, Jimmy, or else. No, it's to give you a lot to think about. And then you decide. That's up to you. I can decide for me. And I think you can see in the book, I don't mind showing what I think about things, but it's up to you to decide for yourself. And so the book is aimed at several particular audiences. And I would say in one would be those fundamentalists who interpret the Bible in a literal way and who have some suspicion, gnawing suspicion, particularly because of Darwin's theory of evolution, that science has somehow lined up against them. And that's partly because the atheists, and I might say really the anti-theists, those who are trying to proselyte, to eliminate faith among others, have said that if you have evolution, you don't need God. And the fundamentalists came back and said, well, if you believe in God, you can't believe in evolution. And I'm trying to say, well, yes, you can believe that. Science, if it does anything, is helping us to understand, it reveals to us how God arranged to do things for those of us who are believers. And so I would say to the believer, science is not the enemy of faith. You don't have to be a scientist. There's nothing in the book that would turn you away from your faith. That's up to you. But science is not the enemy. And in fact, the deeper we go into the molecular structure we're talking about, the structure of DNA, it's a helix, but it's a right-handed helix, not left-handed. It's a righty-tighty, just like every wood screw at the hardware store. They all go the same way. You'd mess up if they didn't. And so if you see that, you see that it's so complex. The code of DNA is so extraordinarily large, vast, that there are 3 billion elements of code in there. Nothing like that in your computer, in our respective servers here. The deeper you go, the clearer it becomes that we didn't get here by unguided chance. Now, you think about that. You can agree, you can disagree. But if you disagree, well, you have to say, well, yeah, we got here by unguided chance. That's a lot to think about.
It is. And this is something that I always just been thinking that, you know, that we're not here by accident. And that's why I, in one hand, you know, I think that, you know, we're created here, but then on the other hand, I understand the science portion as well. And holding those two ideas and then trying to have a conversation with someone about that is very difficult because they're typically going to be having their ideology on one of those sides. And it's going to be hard for them to see anything on the other side. So when you were, what was the motivation for writing this book?
Well, I had had two occasions to meet Dr. Francis Collins, who's the head of the National Institutes of Health. Before that, you know, he was the head of the human genome that figured out the code of DNA first in humans and then in other animals where they could see some striking similarities in the comparison. But he had written a book called The Language of God. Think of that, The Language of God. That's a metaphor for the DNA code that he knew so very well. And I talked with him. I said, well, you ought to introduce some material from the field of organic chemistry, in particular the three-dimensional structures, as I was just talking about. And I noticed his next book didn't have that. So I decided, well, I think I'll write that. I've been in chemistry for 12 years. And I said about it. It took me 6 years, but I have chapters on astronomy, physics, geology, paleontology, the study of fossils, biochemists. And all of these topics have been covered in other books, but I do them to build up a base so that when we get to chemistry, you are prepared to see something that you won't find in any other book. And it's a lot of information about complexity at the molecular level. You see, back ever since Darwin, atheists to a degree had the upper hand because they were talking about comparative anatomy of all species that we can see today, plus all the fossils that were out there. And it was just looking at the structure that you can see on a human scale, either small or large, but from human eyes. And they had an advantage. But when you get into the molecular structure of DNA, the fact that it is a double helix, two spirals going around each other with cross bridges along the way, which constitute the code of 3 billion elements, as I said a moment ago. But let me tell you how many possibilities that is if you calculate up the different ways you could arrange those 3 billion elements of code is 10 to the almost 2 billionth power. That is a 1 followed by 1.9 billion zeros.
That's even hard to comprehend.
Yeah. How's that going to happen by chance to get the code just right? If the code isn't right, there's no life. The code has to be right in many different ways for different species. But if it's not right, there are no species. How'd that happen by chance? So I decided that there needed to be, at least in the public record, a book on the chemistry of life and let people think about that. Because for one thing, the structure that's worked out for DNA absolutely, in my view, absolutely proves evolution because it shows how the variety, how the hybridization can happen. you get errors in that code, and they're either damaging and you lose that particular species, new species, or it's favorable and you get an advantage. And it accounts for the replication of the DNA from one DNA per cell to two just before cell division, so that each new cell has the correct code. It accounts for the way that the code in one gene gets transferred to a messenger RNA, and that determines the order in which 20 different kinds of amino acids get incorporated into a particular protein. And there's one gene for each protein. All of this is so fabulous that to many of us, it has all the trappings of a miracle, because the first cell had to have all of this just right.
Yeah. So,
second cell.
That's a lot to just chew in when you think about so much complexity going on. And I guess when I think about that, I understand why sometimes it is hard to see, can religion and science coexist? Because when you do that, you're adding even more complexity in there. And I think sometimes we try to shy away from the complexity. No. And that brings me to the next point. So combining science and religion already can kind of bring some complexity, but there's a third beast that I call it that can really make things kind of hairy, and that's politics. And that's on both sides, because typically I think today you can kind of tell someone's ideology by how they believe in things or certain answers to certain things, which probably not the best thing, but it is what it is. So that was an interesting chapter. I'm sure that's one of your most popular chapters now.
It's hard to tell because you don't know where. You can take the book and read any chapter at a time. Each chapter itself carries itself through. But yes, there is a chapter, the next to last chapter, the politics of science and religion. And it deals with the First Amendment, what it actually says. It doesn't talk about a separation of church and state. It says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So it talks about how sometimes the Supreme Court comes down on the establishment side and says you can't do that. Sometimes it comes down on the protection of the freedom of religion. And that's an interesting part of it. But then we get into how science plays in that. And I would say that, I think anyone would say that my party has been correctly labeled anti-science, because some conservatives have taken a view. I don't know if it's because they really have a belief that something isn't right, or if it's because they side with their tribe. You know, the leaders say this and can't be, and they fight against something. So sometimes that will influence where people come down. Now, this doesn't apply to all Republicans or all conservatives, but it's in my party where you're likely to hear people say that evolution is false, that the age of the earth is less than 10,000 years, whereas science would say it's close to 4.5 billion years. They'll say that global warming, climate change, is a myth. They're the ones who will be opposed to the use of stem cells, embryonic stem cells in particular. And recently, they've been the ones who have been more opposed to mandated COVID-19 abatement measures, masks, vaccination, whatever it might be. Well, it might not be as well known, but there's just as much science denial on the left, on the
absolutely
government. And they're fortunate not to have been attacked much by and it's just like with Republicans, not everyone feels this way, but before COVID the opposition to vaccination was from those on the far left. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be able to make their own decisions and not be told what to do. It's on the left that you're more likely to find people opposed to nuclear power as a way to solve global warming. And you know, I'm for photovoltaic cells, I'm for windmills, I'm tough on birds, whatever. You got to do a lot of these things. I'm for all of the above. But if you don't include nuclear power, I say you're not serious about global warming and trying to solve it, because there's nothing else that has the capacity for not just our way of life, but for the economies of emerging nations. We're going to keep telling them, no, you got to stay down because we don't have room for your carbon dioxide. We got to have a better answer to that. It's on the left that you'll find opposition to food additives, like artificial sweeteners, for example. I was in that battle in Congress, opposed to food made from genetically modified organisms. On all of these, scientists are 90 to 95% in agreement that, one, you should get vaccinated, if not just for yourself, for all your neighbors. We have to have nuclear power. That's 95% of scientists say that's essential if we're going to solve the problem. Synthetic food additives, those from food from genetically modified organisms, are the key to being able to provide enough food for hundreds of millions of people around the planet. It's on the left where you'll see opposition to the use of animals for laboratory, for medical research. I was involved with that, and there's standards. You have to be very careful and sensitive and avoid pain. And there are important standards for that. But there's some who say we shouldn't use them at all. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to experiment on humans. That's one of the reasons that there's the memory of the Tuskegee experiment. Which unfortunately has caused some minorities to be wary of the COVID vaccine. And yet the Tuskegee experiment was telling people they had a therapy when they didn't. And that was abuse. Now we've got a vaccine that works for 95% and people need to move in. I'm just pleased that the clergy and doctors have been working to try to reassure people that it's the right thing to do. Well, so yeah, the chapter on the politics has a lot of good stories there. Before that is too, it's a search for life and extraterrestrial intelligence on other planets.
Has politics become even more tribal now than when it was when you were in politics?
It was certainly tribal. You had your party and your alignment. And if there was a particular issue where you felt pretty strongly that your party was the wrong way, well, you had to act on your own judgment about that and defend that to your people. I found that worked pretty good. But when you got to vote, those of us on the minority knew that we were going to lose that vote unless we had done some careful planning in advance to get allies on the majority at that time, the Democrats, on the majority to work with us on incorporating an amendment, and we could do that. When it was over, whether you won or lost, you went on to something else, because you could find something else to work on. And there was a friendship across party lines. Today, that's been seriously interrupted. And there are a lot of factors. One, of course, is that the gerrymandering is something that's been there since 1812. And so it's been around a long time, but now it's on steroids. The high-powered computers that can give you the dozen best, most effective ways to dismiss the other party, no matter which party you're in. It works this way. If you're in the minority party in a state, you're against gerrymandering. If you're in the majority, maybe you used to be against gerrymandering, but not anymore. And somehow we've got to get a way to do that. Now, there's another factor, though, that's that's a new development, and that is the internet, right where we are, because it enables people to find blogs that they like health, and it could be like politics, but in particularly in the political blogs, they can get fed the same argument over and over and never hear the other side. And so they don't have any respect for those on the other side. And you tend to demonize people if you don't have respect for them. That would never happen when I was in Congress. If you even challenge somebody's motives, if you said, oh, the reason so-and-so is doing this is because of some ulterior motive, you got shut down for the rest of the day in the House of Representatives. You couldn't speak on anything.
Oh, wow.
Several people call that. They don't do that anymore. I mean, it's attacking each other on a personal basis goes on all the time. But the way that social media has enabled us to be in our own, each of us in our own silo, and maybe we're in an area where there's similar silos with people who have almost the same views. We just don't hear the other side. And that's why I think it's important to do a little bit of surfing at news time late in the afternoon. Maybe like MSNBC or CNN, which are more on the left. I'll watch those for the news coverage from 5 to 6, and from 6 to 7, I'll watch Fox News. I get my side. Sometimes I don't agree with that. Mostly I do. Sometimes I agree, but mostly I don't, with those on the left. But that's my mind working with the information I've got. And I think it's important to know what both sides are doing. But most people, I guess, figure they don't have time for that.
It's
their tribe, as you said. And then they tune in on just that one repetitious version of against vaccination as a case, or against nuclear power,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. And you know, whether you're for it or whether you're against it, it's oftentimes whatever side you're on, they're going to paint a certain image of the person that's on the other side, basically.
Yep.
Creating an enemy of like every person that doesn't think like you is this type of person, and you shouldn't like this person. When really, you know, as we said at the beginning, that there's nuances and everyone has all sorts of different reasons why they would be for something or against it. And it's not always the narrative that you hear. There's a reason that the narrative. And so I'm in complete agreement, because I do this in my field as well in health, that I will consume all viewpoints of a potential topic, just so I can have a full understanding of it. Because at the very least, when I come across someone and they might have a viewpoint that I'm not as strongly held in, I can at least understand their viewpoint. And so that seems like, and that leads me to the next thing, which is North Carolina is notoriously a blue state. And you were the third, one of only three Republicans elected to the governor's seat, and the only one to serve 2 terms. So I'm curious, what do you think made you effective to cross the quote unquote party lines? Because to do that, you effectively had to get some Democrats to vote for you.
I would say, first of all, North Carolina is closer to being a purple.
Oh, okay.
We have a Democrat governor, mm-hmm. a previous governor was Republican, one before that was Democrat. Then you go back to me, and then Governor Hunt was after me, but also before me. And so we've got, Governor Holzhauser before him, a Republican. So we've got an electorate that for that office has been able to choose candidates of each party. It depends, I guess, on which one they thought had the most to offer. A lot of different factors get taken into that. But until 1986, 87, other than the top of the ticket, it was a solid blue state, a Democrat dominant it was the conservative Democrats that controlled the entire Southeast, North Carolina, your state, Tennessee, every state in the Southeast was totally dominated by the Democratic Party. Very few Republican congressmen, an occasional governor. And so Governor Alexander and I became friends, and from now Senator from Tennessee. And we worked on an effort to get those who would vote for Nixon or for Reagan for president, for us for governor, to switch their registration so that when they got to the campaigns, that they did not know who the candidate was or what they stood for, instead of going back to their party on the Democrat side and voting straight Democrat on everything else. Hopefully we'd get some of those voting straight Republican, and it worked. And so we went from a heavily Democrat South to in some states you'd say we went too far. The Republicans are heavily in control, but in North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia increasingly, certainly Virginia, and I think you see this in Florida, it's shifting more toward a balance, which is what we had in mind all along. How do you rather than having a single party dominating politics, wouldn't it be better to have the conflict of two parties? Now, we didn't count on social media making them so polarized, but we do have competitive parties in the state and in your state.
I do think, though,
and we succeeded. Mm-hmm. Lamar was a great friend during that time, and we got people from other states. Carol Campbell from South Carolina, who was then in the House but was running for governor. Newt Gingrich, you might know that name.
Mm-hmm. I do.
He was in our group, and we met at Blackberry Farm in Tennessee.
I do think, though, when you, like you said, when you have more of a balance, you know, you have one side and the other side, and you come together, and I think that's how you get the best ideas to win. And ultimately, then the people win because you have the best ideas.
Right. That takes a willingness to compromise. Now, here's what happened, and I can say this more clearly in North Carolina. We register by party. Most states do, some don't. And so we moved from having like an 80 to 20 split of Democrats and Republicans to something like 55-45, okay, enough for the Republican, the smaller party, to still be able to recruit more talent to run and to manage campaigns. And so we were able to compete. But as the parties became more polarized, as they are today, and again, that gets back to both gerrymandering, which gives safe seats for Republicans are going to be more far to the right. Safe seats for Democrats are more likely to be far to the left. But one other thing happened. The moderates pulled out of both parties. And so today, moderates make up a third of the electorate in North Carolina. Republicans are 30%, 31%. Democrats, 35. The non-affiliated, 33. And that means there's no overlap. There's no, you don't have any liberal thinking, moderate liberals in the Republican Party. You don't have any moderate conservatives. I'm talking about good numbers in the Democrat. And so they don't have to talk to each other. But this side, whichever you call it, whichever party, this side doesn't have to appeal to votes over here. They get elected by the votes here. Those on this side don't have to appeal to these voters. They get their votes over here.
And so I'm curious, and this is backtracking a little bit because I don't even think I asked this.
By the way, I enjoy watching Harold Ford on Fox News. His dad was in the Ways and Means Committee when I was in, got to know him. We were different parties, but adjoining states. And so he was one that I would look forward to work with.
How do you transition from organic, you're doing organic, teaching organic chemistry, and then politics? What is it, curiosity?
was a lust for power in my heart. As Jimmy Carter would say, a lust for power in my heart. I started off doing precinct work. And that was when I really became interested in politics. In college, graduate school, I had enough on my plate with my studies. But raising a family in a small town, I just got involved in the precinct work. And before long, my view was that local governments ought to step up and take care of issues, not just tell the federal government to stay out.
Absolutely.
Solve problems here. One of the issues back at that time was there were laws that would determine where you could live based on your race. It was called blue lining, or red lining, I guess it was. Because the red pen was like, no, this is the line, you got to be here. And when Dr. King was assassinated, we had a public meeting to get people to express their grief. And I was asked to participate. I was chairman of the county commission at that time. The mayor was a Democrat, and he called and said, you and I need to be there and need to speak so that people hear from both parties. And as I thought about it, I said, well, I'm not going to just say, feel your pain, that kind of thing. I came out and said, the issue that was then called open housing, to remove those kinds of laws. And that rather than just argue against the Congress doing it, we in our own community, in our county, should be dealing with that to clean that up. Of course, I got in trouble with some of my conservative supporters who didn't agree with me, but they gave, I guess, respect for my willingness to take on a tough subject. And so there was acceptance when the Congress did pass acceptance in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, my territory.
And one of the last few questions I have is about just the whole mental side and psychology of campaigning. How stressful is that? I'm just curious.
I guess if you fret over it, it could be pretty stressful. I've found that I enjoyed the hand-to-hand combat, if you want to call it that. I learned, for example, that if you're going to campaign outside the plant gate where they make tires, these guys have strong hands, and so you don't want to sacrifice your whole hand in a handshake. Mm-hmm. You grab them by the arm and then do your best to. But after a couple hundred of them go by, they can wear you down. But that was fun, and people were good natured. If they disagree with you, they say so, but generally, back in those days, it was not incriminating. It was not something that there was a personal attack. It's just they were disagreed with your views, and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the interviews with the news media. I did like most politicians. I found things that they would write that I didn't like. That's because they wrote it the way I said it. I mean, hard to complain about that. But, I realized that they were trying to get the essence of a story. Sometimes they have a predetermined idea as to what your motive is, but that goes back to that issue. How do you really know what somebody's motive? Might be a mixture of motives.
So when I was doing some more research, I saw that typically, as we hear with all politicians, that they promise us the moon, that if you elect them, we're going to do all of this and all of that. And I thought it was very interesting from what I read that.
Well, you're right if you believe it.
Yeah. And you said that you're going to address all the priorities in the state, but your only promise was the construction of Interstate 40 being completed, I believe. Is that correct?
Yep.
So I guess that's a very... Was that, I guess, what made you think that? Is that just being different or actually being sticking to your word and being realistic of what could actually happen?
Yeah, all of the above. It was symbolic. Every candidate who had ever run for governor since the interstate system had been started promised to build I-40 all the way down to Seaport at Wilmington, the only seaport on the East Coast that didn't have a four-lane highway, expressway, within 60 miles. And so I said, in my first term, it will all be under construction. Won't be able to finish it, but it'll all be under construction. The contracts will be let, and it'll be committed. Or you can hold me accountable for that. Now, every county said, oh, but what about Highway US 421? What about 17? What about this? What about that? I said, look, my opponent's going to promise all of those. I'm only going to promise I-40. But you've got just as good a chance to get some of those others from me as you do from him. And unpromised paving is more honorable than unpaved promises. And that was a pretty good campaign slogan, and it worked pretty well.
That is a very good campaign slogan.
Yeah, I did have other positions on education, for example, tax policy, on economic development generally. But on highways, sure enough, my opponent made accusation that I was not promising all these other highways. But that played into my hands because I had made that a very sharp, unusual issue. And it worked very well. That road was under, that highway was under construction and now completed. And that region of the state has taken off because of that.
And that's a very good metaphor for life and for a lot of the listeners out there listening about being truthful about what can actually be done and then really just sticking to your promises. So I think about relationships. I even think about sometimes with clients where you have all these things that you want to get done, but it's a matter of priorities and it's a matter of really focusing on the big thing. And like you said, that interstate was the big thing because it kept just lingering on and on and on.
Yep.
So this has been an awesome conversation. Really cool. I could probably talk with you for hours. There's a dozen other questions I have, but I want to be respectful of your time. And where can we get the book at?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can go to a website. Let me tell you, it's www.beatenpathbooks, BEATENPATHBOOKS, one word.
Okay.
Beaten Path Books. That's my my own website. And so you could go to there. But you can certainly pick it up at Barnes & Noble at their stores or their internet site.
Okay. And listeners, if case you're driving or anything out there, I will have all of this in the show notes to where you can pick up the book. Governor Martin, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great conversation.
Right. And if there's anybody that that can't afford the $4 for the ebook, tell them to get the word to you and you send it to me.
Okay.
I'll get them a code.
Okay? Absolutely. I will do that.
Read about it. I think it'll help them.
Absolutely. I very much so. That's a very kind and generous thing of you. And so listeners, definitely take them up on that. Reach out to me and my contact information will be there. And so until next time, listeners out there, stay awesome, be limitless, and as always, go be superhuman. Peace.